This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
That part of the country is home to more than 1 million South Sudanese refugees, most of whom have arrived since 2016. The influx has created tension with locals who feel the refugees get better treatment than they do.
And that's Halima Athumani reporting on rising tensions in northern Uganda caused by the influx of refugees. Also, a Mali man accused of serving as the head of the police for religious militants in Timbuktu faces charges of crimes against humanity in the International Criminal Court. We'll have these stories for you and more, so do stay with us. There is lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. In our top story, authorities in Cameroon have freed 18 people, including 12 European tourists, who were seized by armed separatists fighting for the independence of the country's English-speaking regions. Dozens of hostages are still in captivity. Moki Edwin Kinzika is in Yaounde for us with this report.
12 of the 18 former hostages looked tired, hungry and unkempt as they arrived in Yaounde Tuesday. They refused to grant interviews. Communications Minister Issa Chiruma says the 7 Swiss nationals and 5 Italians were freed from the bushes of Manyu, an administrative unit on Cameroon's southwestern border with Nigeria, after a battle between Cameroon government troops and armed separatists. Chiruma says local residents told the military where the hostages had been taken to.
Les 12 touristes sont parmi nous grâce à la collaboration.
He says the 12 tourists regained their freedom thanks to the collaboration between the population, self-defense groups and forces of law and order. He says many hostage takers were neutralized. Chiruma said the tourists were visiting a twin lake in the locality of Ngute when armed men seized their vehicle and held them hostage for several days. After they were freed, the tourists were taken to a hospital for medical care, from where they will be handed over to their embassies for return travel formalities. 6 municipal councillors who were kidnapped in the northwest while going to vote in the country's senatorial election have also been freed. The separatists had warned them not to vote, saying that English-speaking Cameroon was now an independent country called Ambazonia and will not accept any election organized by a foreign country. Last week, a Tunisian was killed in another operation in Manyu Division in which 4 engineers were freed. Cameroon says at least a dozen other people, including 2 senior state officials, are still being held hostage by the separatists. Didier Bajek, a spokesperson for the Cameroon military, says allegations the military commits atrocities while fighting separatists are lies that should not discourage the population from working with them.
La réalité de ce théâtre est que nos forces font preuve de sang-froid, elles restent professionnelles.
He says the military has remained professional, even though the terrorists are using social media to accuse them of committing atrocities. He says they will fight until all Cameroon is free and all those held hostage released. Tensions started in Cameroon in 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers went on strike to protest what they called the overbearing use of French. The government says hundreds of people, including 30 policemen and soldiers, have been killed this year. Embassies in Cameroon have been cautioning their nationals against traveling to the English-speaking regions. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaounde.
Some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind.
That was Martin Luther King Jr., the American civil rights leader, speaking at a rally just a day before he was assassinated in 1968. Today, on the 50th anniversary of his death, people across the United States are holding ceremonies to honor King and pledge to carry on his work for social and economic justice. King was a church pastor from the southern state of Georgia. He went on to lead the movement to end laws that discriminated against Black Americans and other minorities. He was gunned down at a hotel in Memphis, Tennessee, where he had been supporting striking sanitation workers. James Earl Ray was convicted of the killing and spent the rest of his life in prison. Some of King's family and supporters, however, have said they believe others were involved in his death, although no courts have found proof of other killers. King's death sparked protests and riots in cities across the country. But at his funeral in his hometown of Atlanta, Georgia, more than 100,000 people marched peacefully through the streets behind the wagon bearing his coffin. The UN Refugee Agency says it regrets Israel's decision to cancel an agreement to resettle thousands of Eritrean and Sudanese asylum seekers, but remains hopeful that a solution still can be found. Lisa Schlein reports for us from the UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
There are about 39,000 Eritrean and Sudanese asylum seekers in Israel, most of them living in poor neighborhoods of Tel Aviv. On Monday, Israel and the UN Refugee Agency announced an agreement to send some of the refugees to Western countries, while allowing others to remain in Israel under temporary visas and find jobs. This elicited a howl of protest from right-wing allies of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who consider the Africans illegal immigrants. Netanyahu canceled the agreement the next day. Earlier, Israel said it would give the refugees a choice, accept relocation to African countries or face extended time in jail. Several NGOs opposed to that took their case to Israel's Supreme Court, which ruled in favor of the refugees and froze the policy. What happens next, says UN Refugee Agency spokesman William Spindler, is up in the air.
So we are back to square one, if you like. The controversial policy of sending these people to countries in Africa has been frozen by the High Court in Israel. The countries that were supposed to take them have denied that they are part of these agreements.
Spindler says the UNHCR's offer to work with the Israeli government still stands. He says the agreement canceled this week would provide a solution for the Africans who are in need of protection from war and persecution. At the same time, he says it would meet the concerns of the local Israeli communities hosting them. Spindler says the policy of sending refugees to Africa, reportedly to Uganda and Rwanda, was widely criticized because it was not in the best interest of the refugees.
Once the refugees arrive there, they find very little possibility to integrate. Many of them don't feel safe there. And then they continue in long, dangerous routes, risking their lives. Once again, because many of them went through terrible ordeals before they arrived in Israel. So once again, they will be on the move.
However, Spindler says the current situation is not tenable, and ultimately, Israel and the UNHCR must find a way out of this impasse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Tensions are mounting in Sierra Leone as people anxiously await the official results of Saturday's presidential runoff election. Supporters on both sides have already claimed victory, raising concerns of possible unrest. Olivia Ackland is in Freetown for us with this report.
At the headquarters of the opposition SLPP, women sell posters of candidate Madibio, along with green SLPP wristbands, flasks and whistles. A large group of people dance in front of the giant green office. Inside, Abubakar Cisse, editor of Unity, the party newspaper, sits around chatting to his friends. He's confident his party has won based on its private tally, but is anxious for the National Electoral Commission, or NEC, to announce the official result. He says the rumours are dangerous.
People just sit down in the comfort of their chairs or their homes and then post all sorts of things oh, this will happen tomorrow. Some people are planning this. This is going to, you understand? And so there are most people in our society, they are very gullible. You know, they swallow some of these things, hook, line, and sinker. You know, that is what is creating the tension. Otherwise, we have been using the mainstream media to appeal to them to become...
At the headquarters of the ruling APC party, music is blasted from speakers outside, but the mood is subdued. President Ernest Bai Koroma had to stand down this year, having served the limit of 2 terms. The first round of voting was close, with ruling party candidate Samora Wilson Kamara trailing Biya by less than 15,000 ballots. The APC challenged the first round results, alleging fraud and delaying the runoff by 4 days. One APC supporter, Osman Kanu, is ready to protest the result of the runoff if it doesn't go the way he hopes.
The APC, the All People's Congress, won the election, and we, the people, voted for the All People's Congress vehemently in all districts. If the results are not credible enough, the NEC officials do not give the people the right choice which they have made, we are ready, we are prepared to demonstrate. And these are our placards. We need credible results in Sierra Leone.
The rumour mill is working overtime, adding to the tensions. APC supporters claim that members of the international community, specifically Ghanaian President John Mahama and the British High Commissioner, are meddling on behalf of the opposition, accusations those officials have denied.
Tell these guys to stay out of our politics. This is our internal politics.
If you don't stay out of Sierra Leone politics, no bridges will ever regret it.
Most Sierra Leoneans just want to hear the results as soon as possible.
This is how they make this tea.
Mohamed Sanko sits smoking cigarettes with some friends at a roadside stall. He worries that children need to get back to school after nearly a month off and that parents need to get back to work.
The common Sierra Leonean doesn't have money for safekeeping. They only live on a day-to-day basis. People cannot go to work because they are fear of any outbreak. They don't want to leave their children at home, then they go to work. So things are just upside down.
The National Electoral Commission has said it expects to announce results on Thursday. It's Olivia Ackland for VOA News, Freetown.
A recent study says Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia face persistent unrest because of perceived government indifference to marginalized border areas. The Africa Center for Strategic Studies report recommends that the three governments revise their policies on the border areas to reduce opportunities for exploitation by criminal networks and militant groups. Professor Anwar Bukhart, the author of the study, spoke to VOA's Mohamed El Shenawi about the instability in the Maghreb countries and what to do about it.
These regions have been scarred by a history of neglect. When you look at poverty rates, for example, they're often more than triple that of urban areas. I mean, in Algeria's south, oil and gas industry, which represents 35% of GDP and 75% of government revenue, is located in the south. Nonetheless, the south is often trivialized and it has been neglected. When you talk to Saharan communities, they see that this score smacks of racial prejudice, of deliberate intention to justify their political and socioeconomic exclusion. The government's laissez-faire approach to these regions, whether it's in Algeria or Morocco or Tunisia, they adopted a laissez-faire approach to informal cross-border trade. That contributed to making contraband a dominant economic activity. It provides a lifeline to populations that are deprived of the financial benefits of the region's natural resource endowments. So that's why we have seen that these regions have been riven by protests against social exclusion, against high unemployment, against environmental degradation. So when you have state institutions that are not legitimate, that are not credible, so no wonder, I mean, you have this intrusion of militancy, of arms and drugs trade. The center of gravity for this toxic cocktail today is really North Africa's marginalized border areas, from Morocco's restless northern reef region to the farthest reaches of the troubled southern regions of Algeria and Tunisia.
You stated in your study that security forces usually resort to heavy-handed response to security threats without paying attention to grievances in marginalized areas. Is that the right way?
Boost boosting border controls is important, but it's insufficient to protect against these internal and cross-border threats. Morocco in particular, but also Algeria and Tunisia, they do deserve a pat on the back because they managed to contain the threat of terrorism within their borders. But if history is any guide, the threat of terrorism will linger and remain a challenge unless governments get serious about addressing the long-standing grievances, the resentments that are prevalent among these communities.
So what's your recommendations to mitigate the threat of instability in border areas of the three Maghreb countries?
First is that you have to improve community engagement skills of the police, the security forces. I mean, the persistent stigmatization of these peripheral communities, like in Tunisia and Algeria, you know, they're being described as troublemakers, as outlaws. You know, the trauma that is associated with aggressive policing, it instills in young people profound feelings of humiliation. So we need to overcome this trust deficit between the security services and the local communities. Two is that all three states that you mentioned, they need to recognize the historical specificity and the geographic particularity of these border regions. So we need to heal these past wounds. So if these are accompanied by development activities that cater to regional needs, if there is an improvement in the management of natural resources, if the local people see that the state is investing a fair portion of these profits from local resources into local projects, I think those gestures will help mitigate the sentiments of anger that we see among peripheral communities. And frankly, they can also help counter extremist recruitment.
And that was Anwar Bukhars at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking there to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. A Mali man accused of destroying cultural sites in Timbuktu and victimizing women and girls has made his first appearance before the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Al-Hassan Al-Abdulaziz Ahmohamed Ahmahmoud was captured over the weekend in Mali on an arrest warrant issued by the court. Prosecutors say Hassan headed the Islamic Police in Timbuktu when it was under the control of religious militants 5 years ago. He only had to confirm his name and date of birth Wednesday. Next up is a September 24 hearing to confirm the charges of crimes against humanity, rape, torture and sex slavery. Prosecutors say the 40-year-old member of the Ansar Din jihadist group was the de facto chief of the Islamic Police in Timbuktu and personally took part in whippings for violations of Islamic laws. He allegedly approved marriages of local women to Islamist fighters. Expected to testify against him is Ahmed Al-Faqi Al-Mahdi, who admitted to destroying cultural sites in Timbuktu. He was sentenced to 9 years in jail in 2016. The refugee population in Uganda stands at more than 1.4 million and growing, thanks to conflicts in South Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The influx is now forcing Uganda to rethink its decades-old policy of allocating plots of land for refugees to farm and live on. For VOA, Halima Athumani reports from Kyangwali Refugee Settlement in western Uganda.
The Congolese refugees arrive on the Ugandan side of Lake Albert aboard rickety boats. More than 60,000 have come since the start of the year. They are fleeing a fresh wave of communal violence in the northeastern DRC. Now, the Changwali refugee settlement is growing crowded. Nzeimane Emmanuel fled to Uganda in 2014. The government gave him use of a 9-by-9-meter plot of land in Changwali. The recent violence in Congo forced his family to join him. He says, we used to farm, but now the gardens have been reduced. Because of the influx, they told us we can't continue farming. Uganda began allocating land to refugees in the early 1960s. Ownership remains with the government or host communities, but refugees use the plots for free, building small homes of mud and wattle and cultivating small gardens. The goal is to make refugees self-reliant and able to feed themselves. But amid the influx from Congo, the government says it must redesign some settlements, including Changwali.
Musa Echweru is Uganda's Minister for Relief, Disaster Management and Refugees.
So that refugees will not be scattered through the camp like we have to date handled. We are going to reorganize them to the extent that there will be settlement on just one side of the camp. And then three quarters of the camp should be used for extensive agriculture.
The refugee influx from Congo over the past 3 months has already exceeded the UN's projection for all of 2018, and more are expected. But a potentially bigger challenge remains in northern Uganda. That part of the country is home to more than 1 million South Sudanese refugees, most of whom have arrived since 2016. The influx has created tension with locals who feel the refugees get better treatment than they do. Gilbert Olanya is a member of National Parliament from Northern Uganda.
You find the citizen of this country is going angry. There's no food, but refugees are being supplied with enough food. No proper medical services, but in the refugees' camp, there are good medical services. No water supply, but in the camp, there are clean water. Therefore, we really feel the government is not doing much for the local people who have given their land to the refugees to settle in.
Some communities have demanded they also get priority for jobs with aid groups serving the refugees. Frustrations have flared in recent months. There have been reports of local residents assaulting refugees, attempting to block access for aid groups or banning the group's vehicles. Halima Athmani for VA News, Changwali, Uganda.
Stanbic, a locally based international bank in Zimbabwe, recently marked International Women's Month with the launch of a project to provide sanitary pads to rural women. It's estimated 7 in 10 girls in the country's rural primary schools have no access to sanitary pads when they menstruate. VOA's correspondent Adi Gondo spoke to Nyasha Mutsai, Stanbic's human capital executive, to find out more about the project.
Many rural women have to do without what their urban counterparts consider basic amenities. Chipoma Warire, 28 years of age, has some strong views about the plight of women in difficult circumstances.
This being Women's Month, it's really good to have underprivileged women getting help with their sanitary wear, because I hear some even go to the point of using leaves, and that is, besides being uncomfortable and improper, it's also unhealthy.
Come 2018, the women of Stanbic began to look outside of themselves to see how they could uplift and empower women in difficult circumstances. That led to the start this month of the sanitary wear project called My Sister's Keep.
I believe with Women's Month, it's us uplifting each other.
The project was initiated by the female employees who make up 47% of the bank's workforce. With Zimbabwe's unemployment rate running at over 80%, there are plenty of needy women to help, especially among the rural populace. Lack of sanitary products has stopped girls from attending class during their monthly cycles and has put them at serious health risk.
Someone does not have a sanitary pad. Someone does not even know what a sanitary pad is. And that's really sad. And I believe helping women with sanitary wear should be a priority than having high teas and dinners for Women's Month.
The bank's wide reach should help to reach the intended beneficiaries. Stanbic has 23 outlets, and the female employees at each one will identify where the needs are. Then they can donate to a specific school or a clinic to help women after maternity. Reporting for VOA from Harare, this is Adi Gondo.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, do visit our website at voaafrica.com. And please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. That's coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, thank you for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, We continue our discussion about presidential transitions on the continent. We'll take a closer look at Sierra Leone, where a troubled runoff is underway. Sierra Leone Supreme Court approved the Election Commission's request to delay the runoff presidential vote after the lifting of an interim injunction that had stalled preparations.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.